Welcome to The Wonder, exploring perspectives, rituals, and observances of modern, naturalistic, earth-revering, pagan religious paths. Here are your hosts, Yucca and Mark.
Welcome back to The Wonder, science-based paganism. I'm your host, Mark.
And I'm Yucca.
And we're glad to have you back. Today we're going to be talking about one of the most important sets of skills that a pagan or witch can develop for themselves, in our opinion. And that is the harnessing the narrative ability of your mind in order to take an inward journey. Mm-hmm. We were talking about this before we started recording, and both of us have had many powerful experiences and informative experiences by learning to go inward and to encounter figures, experience sensations, view landscapes, which are not physically present around us. It's strictly something that happens inside our mind. So we'll be having a couple of examples at the end of this podcast episode. And we also were going to talk for a while about the skills that can be used in order to accomplish this and the two different main categories of inward journeys.
That's right. Yeah. So I think the first thing is just a little bit of terminology. So we're calling it inward journeying or journeys, but there's a lot of other terms out there that people use. Some of them are a little bit problematic, other ones not as much. I tend to use the word for myself, journey, or if it's something that I'm creating for someone else, I'll talk about a guided meditation. But sometimes you'll hear the term pathworking as well, though that can have slightly different connotations. All of these can have slightly different connotations depending on who you're speaking to and the context.
Yes, and then of course there is the term shamanism, which is a problematic term now, and it's problematic for a number of reasons. The two primary ones, as I understand it, are that, first of all, the word derives from a Tunguskan word from Siberia. It's an indigenous word, and the people of that culture feel that it should only be applied to them, to the particular kind of journeying work that they do and that their holy people do in order to bring information and healing to their group. Other indigenous people that I've heard speak about this issue also feel like throwing all indigenous sort of pathworking or journey working into a big bucket and labeling it shamanism is a very colonialist and insulting thing to do, and I tend to agree with them. So
really Disneyfies very real experiences that people have and very, very distinct cultures.
Right? Yes.
It's really not fair to say that all the people from this entire massive two continents is just one culture or, you know, that sort of thing.
Yes, exactly. Because this sort of journeying is done by people all over the world. It's done by people far above the Arctic Circle. It's done by people in the tropics. And how they do it and the stories that they tell and the symbol sets that they use as they create these journeys inside themselves may vary very widely. But that doesn't mean that what they're doing isn't similar in some fundamental ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But also distinct.
Yeah. And we've been touching on a little bit that this type of inward journeying is something that we've seen in cultures across the globe as well in different time periods. So it's not, as we were saying, it's, you know, not limited to one particular, two particular continents, but many, many different cultures. So I guess let's go with what are some techniques that, or different types of journeys that people can take or practice within their own lives, of course, in a way that isn't appropriating somebody else's practice.
Yes, there are techniques that people can use to get into a trance-like state, and they often involve many of the kind of commonplace ritual technologies that we've talked about here before. Low light levels with flickering light, especially a campfire or a candle, repetitive rhythmic sounds like drumming or even electronic dance music is very trancey, much of it is.
I find fans to be quite trancey, actually. Electric fans.
The sound of an electric fan, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that sort of white noise creation and the sort of oscillating sound. Mm-hmm. So there are many different techniques that you can use in order to go into that sort of light hypnotic state where your focus is in what's happening inside your mind instead of what's happening outside of your body. And there are people that are very skilled at this, people that have trained themselves to do this for a long time, as well as to lead others to do it. I would say that there are two general categories of these sorts of voyages or journeys, and they are the self-guided and then the guided by another, or what you call guided meditations. The easier of the two is the guided meditation, because you have someone who's leading you through a set of imagery that will help you to have an experience, but it's programmed for you. It's easier to get there and to have an experience than it is simply to go into that trance state and then your mind just goes wherever it goes and you see whatever you see. That can be very powerful, but it's also a more advanced technique, I think. And there are certain kinds of care that need to be taken in order to be psychologically healthy, because people can scare themselves if they aren't careful.
And sometimes you might not go in the direction of your intention to begin with, right? If you're wanting to do this for a specific purpose, you're working on, you know, a processing an argument that you had with someone or something like that. Sometimes it can go off, like you're saying, because it is a little bit more of an advanced technique. You can get a little bit more lost, where the guided form can help create a structure that sometimes can be very helpful to have that container and structure within which to work.
Yes.
Yes. So there's definitely benefits to both of them.
Yes. And a part of the art of writing those guided meditations is to leave openings at the appropriate parts of the experience where the person sort of fills in the blanks themselves for what they see or what meaning they find.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise you're just telling them what to experience and it's like reading a book. It's taking an adventure, but it's not really one that is connecting with what's happening inside the person who's taking the adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, which can be fun, but may not be the purpose that someone is looking for.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So I guess this leads me into another conversation, which is all of the things that people do to get themselves into these trancey voyaging states. There are a variety of drugs that people take in order to facilitate or help them to go in these journeying directions. And that, of course, depends on what the laws are in the area where you live and also your own sense of your mental health and what purpose you have. I know people have found psychedelic experiences to be very transformative when combined with this kind of journeying.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I have myself. I've had one experience with ayahuasca, and that was a very, very powerful journeying experience. where I have almost no recollection of being in the room where it was happening, but I have very vivid memories of the journey that I was on during that time. So not to either recommend or dissuade, but we should be aware that one of the reasons why people use mind-altering substances is often to go into that trance state so that they can have these symbolic and meaningful experiences.
Mm-hmm. I do want to encourage people, though, that that's you don't have to.
Oh, right? No.
You can completely, for me, you know, that's something that I have never done, and feel like I have an incredibly rich, vibrant experience with all of this that is very, very meaningful and vivid on many, many levels without that element of it. So, you know, we certainly are not saying one way or the other what someone has to do or that one experience is going to be better or not than the other, right? We're sure, certainly not here for that. Yeah.
Of course.
So, okay, well, we were saying that we have different ways of entering into that state.
Yes, so- and they all go to what I call sort of the core ritual skills. Mm-hmm. Some of them are chanting over and over and over and over again until you come into a trance state. Sometimes it's drumming or using a percussion instrument over and over and again. I know that it can be very trancey simply to have a couple of rattles and shake them next to your ears repeatedly. And that sound, that rhythmic sound will do something to your brain and bring you into a more inward and trance-like state. Mm-hmm. Movement. The very famous whirling dervishes are doing exactly that. They are spinning over and over as they pray and getting into a more and more removed trance state because they're doing this repetitive motion over and over again. Singing, especially singing in groups where you're singing in harmony, is extremely trancey, very, very trance-inducing, and can often lead to wonderful experiences.
Watching flames, whether that's a single candle or your campfire or your wood-burning stove, whatever that is, and the breath. Breath is, the counting of the breath or the simple breathing is another one that leads into that.
Yes. Listening to running water is another. I'm convinced that a part of the reason that people are so attracted to fires and to waterfalls and so forth is because of exactly that effect. There's this calming, slowing down, easing sense. Mm-hmm. And all of those are necessary in order to feel secure enough in order for your mind to go somewhere. So I think all of those are important ways of approaching this.
And you know what? I actually want to step back before even beginning the entering process is making sure that you are in a physical location where you feel safe, right? So definitely not when you're driving your car, but where you can actually be somewhere where you can let down a little bit and you don't feel like you are about to get interrupted or about to be whatever it is, but you just have to be able to physically on that very animal level be somewhere safe before starting the entering into the trance-like state.
That's a very good point. And there are physical attributes as well. And it depends on what your approach is. Sometimes people will fast leading up to their desire to go on a journey because the lack of nutrition kind of helps to make them a little lightheaded and makes it easier to enter into that trance state. Mm-hmm. Other people find that extremely exhausting when they come out the other side of the journey. They feel really kind of wrung out. And so they have to make sure that they eat before they have a journey experience. So it's really a matter of knowing your own body and knowing what's good for you.
Mm-hmm. and the level of experience that you're wanting to have as well. There's a depth to, there's different depths of a journey, right? You could be talking about a journey that's your, that's a 15 minute kind of daily activity that you're doing, or maybe this is your once a season or once a year deep dive into your, you know, the deepest caverns of your emotions or whatever it is, right?
Yes.
So this is, you know, we're talking about this huge, huge field. So we're only able to speak in real general terms with this.
Right.
Yeah.
And journeys are often defined in terms of landscapes. So as people enter into the trance state, many people report the virtual experience of going through a tunnel, or in some cases, climbing a tree or a big vine or something to get to a higher place that is a new landscape that reveals things to them. So there's a transportation quality to it, a quality of leaving where you are and passing through some sort of a passageway or transportation method in order to get to a new landscape that then tells you its story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's where often the journey term is coming from. So.
Yes, because you go somewhere else.
Yeah. Okay, so we've found a safe space physically. We've gotten into a trance-like state. We've had some sort of entrance, which might be visualizing going through a cave or climbing or, you know, being brought somewhere. And then you're somewhere else in your mind, right? Mm-hmm. And from there, there's a lot, it really depends on the person, but there's a lot of different directions to go from there. There could be, it could simply be a journey that you're walking through on your own. You could be encountering animals or figures, ideas, yourself. You know, there's a, it's, this is anything goes imagination, dreamlike world, really, at this point.
Yes. Yes. And how you frame the journey will have a lot of influence over what kinds of figures and characters you encounter. So if, for example, your journey is into the wild forest, then you will have a certain kind of encounters. If it is into a walled garden, a highly manicured, beautiful garden that is something that you can keep inside yourself and revisit whenever you need to recharge or feel safe, then you'll have different kinds of encounters there. And it simply depends on what your goals are and what you're up for. Because the less controlled environments will surprise you. You will spring surprises on yourself that you will then have to contend with. But those can also be among the most powerful of the journeys, because encountering aspects of ourselves or of life that we find challenging is the best way to build better relationships with them.
Mm-hmm.
So you go into a space, you're in a trance, you travel through a cavern or a tunnel or whatever that is to a new place. In the new place, you encounter characters, beings, symbols, attributes, archetypes. They may speak to you. They may interact with you in some way. They may have messages for you. When that is all done, it's very important to retrace your steps, to come back so that a part of you isn't left there. At least that's been my experience, that I don't want to just kind of be waked up I want to retreat from that landscape and come back into my regular sensory awareness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when I do my personal journeys, it's often a very landscape sort of journey. And so I do personally take the journey backwards, right? Walk back and come back out where I started. But with some of the guided ones that I create, that I will often invite people to know that that place where they have gone is always accessible, that they can return there. But there is a very important outro element in which you're returning to your normal awareness, where, you know, sometimes getting up and physically shaking or saying your name out loud, you know, looking at your hand, looking in the mirror, doing things like that to separate those two spaces and be fully back here. So I think it's trying to achieve the same thing, but visually or experience what you're doing as the part of the journey isn't necessarily retracing the steps, because I often don't do them as physical journeys, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So.
Sure. I mean, in the case of some of the journeys that I've taken, it's almost been like a zoom lens where I'm just sort of pulled back out of the scene into myself.
Yeah.
But there's a retreat that's happening. There's a distancing that's happening from that inward landscape to where I'm sitting in my chair or standing on a trail or wherever it is that I am. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, you make a really good point. You suggested a number of different ways that people can ground. And I really think that grounding after a trance experience is very important. Eat something solid, not a leafy salad. Eat something, you know, substantial that sits in your stomach and lets you know that you're a physical animal that metabolizes things and you're not just a being of mind. Put your feet in the dirt. Run water over your hands. As you said, you know, look at your hands, look at yourself in the mirror. Reacquaint yourself with the fact that you are in this physical form and it's real.
Some people find saying their name out loud to be a really, you know, good way of doing that as well.
I hadn't heard that before. That's really interesting. I'll have to try that.
Yeah. Or whatever you call yourself. Because some people don't call themselves by the name that other people do. So whatever feels most you to you.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So we both created some sort of sample guided journeys that we're going to share in just a minute. And we thematically tied them together to be sort of a August llamas harvest sort of theme. But do you want to talk a little bit about structurally what you did and why you made some of those choices?
Sure. The guided visualization that I did is about going forward to gather the harvest of what has been planted earlier in life, and to know what it is, and to know what you've achieved, and to let go of what didn't come up very well, and then to return to a state of comfort and satisfaction in a home-like state.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, but it's, once again, it's that circle. It's going out, making the discovery, accomplishing the work, and then coming back.
Hmm.
How about yours?
Well, I did the kitchen after the harvest, the prepping what you have harvest to, I used the metaphor of canning and drying and preparing that to carefully put it away for the future, taking what you have grown, what you have harvested, and taking that with you into what literally would be the coming autumn and winter, but could just be the next stages of what you're doing in life. And when I created it, I used the form that I like to use when doing a guided meditation, which starts by, there's an entrance period, and this doesn't have any drums or anything like that, but it is a relaxation, a focusing on the breath and going through and focusing on the body, releasing the tension there and using that as the entrance into that state. The other thing that I like to do is to really invoke the different senses. So if I'm writing for someone a guided meditation, I'll often actually write down on a piece of paper, because I'll make an outline and then I'll just go from the general outline. I don't write word for word, but I'll write down sound, sight, taste, smell, touch, and proprio, and try and get as many of those, just mention them at some point, because different people experience and have a different relationship. Some people are very visual. Other people are not visual at all. But if you mention the smell can take them there instantly. Mm-hmm. Or so really trying to work in the different senses. And I mentioned the proprio because we don't think about our position as a sense. You know, our five senses are actually, we've got a lot more than just the five that they taught us in kindergarten, right? It's easier to teach your kindergartners their mouth, eyes, nose, ears, and hands, but there's more to it. So how much can you really, how many senses can you bring into a guided meditation like this to invite and pull people in as much as they can, make it as involved and as present as they can be there? And then create opportunities for them to think about and invite them to think about and connect it to their outside life. The other thing I want to mention is when you are listening to a guided meditation, don't be afraid to use the pause button, because different people are going to need different, you might need more space in a certain scene that somebody else listening to the same meditation isn't, because you're having a personal experience when you're traveling through this journey. It's the same way when you're reading a book. Well, you can put the book down for a second and close your eyes and take a deep breath and think about what you just experienced. Right. You can do that with a meditation too. So when I listen to them, I find it helpful just to have my thumb on the pause button so that it's barely more than a little movement. I don't have to even think about it. I could just pause and start again. And then the end of it is that separation that we talked about. An invitation to know that one can always return to this spot in themselves, because this is, even though someone else is telling the story that you're listening to, you're having the experience. Mm-hmm. And it's something that belongs to you, not the person who wrote it. It's your experience. So you can return, you can use it however you want. So there's always an invitation to return. And then the steps of separating yourself and coming back to your normal awareness, back to your normal self. So there's this shell or structure that's created around a guided meditation. And having that structure, each time it creates that the ritual that allows you to enter more quickly and separate it as well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
That's all very well said. Thank you. So, shall we start?
I think we will. Yeah. So we'll start with yours, Mark, and then it will transition into mine. And we want to say that make sure you're not listening to any of these while you're driving or you know, operating any sort of anything that requires your full attention, make sure that you're being safe about it. So we suggest taking, if you are going to listen to these, to find that safe place before you start. Okay.
Begin with a breath. In and out. In, then out again. And notice that you're rocking forward and backward a little bit as you breathe in and out. Rocking forward, rocking backward, rocking forward, rocking backward. And now know that you are sitting in a wooden rocking chair on a wooden porch, overlooking a great field of wheat extending to the horizon. You rock in the chair, back and forth, and the golden stalks wave in the breeze, swirled by eddies of wind, carrying a sweet, heady scent of hay and summer and memory to you. You're at peace. It's a calm time, and you are at home. You stand and step down from the porch, and the boards creak as you walk down the steps to crunch the brown grass below. Rising behind you is the old farmhouse, paint peeling and angles a bit askew with the settling of the years. You feel a fondness for this old farmhouse, because it's a place that is home for you. It's a place where you belong. It's a place that is yours. You walk now to where a barn rises into the blue sky, hayloft open and spilling out hay. The barn doors are open and you step inside where it's cool and dim and turn to a tool rack from which you select a great scythe. You seat yourself astride the pedal grindstone, pumping with your legs to bring the heavy stone up to speed. You can feel the burning in your thighs as you pump the pedals faster and faster, and then spray sparks from the edge of the scythe as you hone the blade to razor sharpness. And when you're done, and the grindstone slowly, slowly returns to a stop, it is time. So you leave the barn with the sharpened scythe. The sun is now bright in your eyes after the dimness of the barn, and you hear under your heels crunch, crunch, crunch across the dried grass. The sun is hot on your back, and you're glad of your wide-brimmed hat. You approach the great field of wheat. Not all of this is yours, of course, and not all of it is ripe, but it's harvest time, and much of what you have planted this season is ready for taking. What is it? What are you taking in at this time? What has become ripe for the early harvest? You draw back the scythe and swing a smooth arc through the wheat, which falls like water before the blade. The harvest is coming in. Your work, your sweat, your aspiration, and the magic of the living world have combined to bring forth the new. You work steadily, smoothly through the wheat, taking only what is yours. You know which part that is. Piles of wheat begin to accumulate, all of what you have accomplished and achieved during this time, your plans made manifest into the reality of the world. And then you come to a little place where the wheat is stunted and has not brought forth many kernels. This too is yours. These are the things you planted that didn't work out. It's not a terrible thing. Everyone has them. Just clear the ground for a new season next year and carry on. And so you walk smoothly, swinging the scythe, the wheat falling, and finally all your wheat is felled. You bend to gather it in sheaves one by one and carry them into the barn, place them on racks where they can dry. And then you return, crunch, crunch, crunch over the dry grass to the porch, where a cold glass of lemonade awaits you. You sit back and take a long sip, delicious, so tart and sweet and refreshing. Your muscles are sore, but you feel satisfaction. You've brought in the harvest and achieved what you planned to do, or something related to it anyway, because life is complex and things change. Congratulations on your harvest. Well done.
Begin by finding a place where you feel safe and comfortable. Close your eyes and take a deep breath in. Breathe in 2, 3, and out 2, 3. Continue to breathe deeply, focusing on your breath. As you breathe, become aware of your shoulders. Feel any tension you're holding there. And with your out-breath, let that tension slip away. And then allow your focus to travel down into your arms and breathe out any tightness you're holding there. Relax your elbows. Loosen your wrists and your forearms. With each out-breath, let the tension slip down and out from your fingers, leaving your body. And feel that nice softness in your shoulders. Now let that relaxation continue up your neck to your jaws. Let any tightness you're holding there just melt away. Release. Breathe out. And release your face, the muscles that you've been holding tight around your eyes and your mouth. Let them go. Soften your forehead, above your ears. Relax the muscles on the back of your head, where your neck and skull meet, and breathe out. Let that tension flow down and out away, relaxing your body. Let the relaxation flow down from your head, your shoulders, into your chest and your upper back, softening as you breathe. Breathe out any tension that you're holding in your stomach. Relax your hips, your thighs. Let your knees soften and your calves relax. Breathe out, out, down through your ankles, through the arches of your feet, and out your toes. and feel for a moment your whole body soft. Take as much time as you need in this relaxed state, breathing in and out. When you are ready, keep your eyes closed, but allow yourself to imagine a soft warmth of light pressing against your closed eyelids. You can feel a warm breeze coming in through the window on your skin. The soft light of summer filtered through the window, through the screen. The smell of herbs, of drying onions, of spices is strong around you. And you can hear the bubbling of tomato paste on the stove. The smell of the tomatoes is almost overpowering, mingling with the fresh herbs that you have picked. You can feel a wooden floor beneath your bare feet, freshly swept and clean, prepared to receive your harvest. When you look about this cheery kitchen, the kitchen of your inner mind, you can see baskets and boxes of your harvest, of the food that you have grown and picked, that you have carefully cared for. There's a hum, a dehydrator already hard at work, drying slices of zucchini that you'll save for the winter and add to your stews, to your soups, and even sweet zucchini breads. Braids of onion and garlic already hang drying next to little bunches of rosemary. Take a moment to stand in your kitchen and enjoy the sight and the sounds of your harvest. There are jars to be washed and prepared. You've already begun carefully scrubbing each glass jar, preparing them, cleaning them to hold your hard work from the growing season. Continue to breathe, to feel the warm water on your skin and the sponge as you scrub each jar. And set them to dry. If you would like, take a moment to think about the things in your own life that you have been growing, that you have been preparing. Maybe not a literal harvest of vegetables and fruits, but what have you been cultivating in your life that you would like to save and bank to take you into the cold half of the year? You begin to process your harvest. Pick up each vegetable, each beet and carrot. Carefully look them over, brushing them off. Scrubbing away any last pieces of dirt. And setting those with bruises aside. You expertly chop and fill your jars, one after another. Until they are ready to lower into the boiling water and seal. One by one, your baskets of produce empty as you take your harvest and prepare them, put them into your jars and seal them up. Your kitchen is peaceful, but busy, productive at work, preparing for the months to come. When the jars are ready, you carefully dry them and label each one with a date and their delicious ingredients. It is time to put them away, to organize and stack them, put them into the cupboards and the pantry. And again, this is a moment to think about your own life and about what you would like to prepare emotionally for the coming months. What are you harvesting? And how are you setting yourself up for success in these coming months? Spend as much time as you need enjoying the harvest kitchen. Caring for your jars, for your produce, prepping them, washing and cutting, drying and filling the jars, lowering them into the boiling water, and labeling and storing them. If you need more time, go ahead and hit the pause button and resume when you are ready to return to your normal awareness. Take a deep breath and open your eyes. Look around the world around you. Maybe shake your shoulders. Pat yourself a few times, say your name out loud, and return to your normal awareness. But know that this kitchen is always inside you for you to return to whenever you need.